accession number 27748, reel 5.
Richard Songer, reel 5. So at the end of your training on the Provost, what happened then?
Oh, then we had, you know, we got a certificate, and we then went to RAF Valley, that's in Anglesey, for our fighter training, or advanced training. Yeah, it wasn't called fighter training, it was the advanced training. Again with the RAF, and that was on the Vampire FB5, which was the single-seat fighter bomber Vampire.
Jet,
yeah, jet aircraft. And
so you made that transition from piston engine to jet?
Yeah,
like that.
In one go, yes. Because jet aeroplanes are always reckoned to be, you know, highly technical, but in fact they're far easier to fly than the piston engine, because when you open the throttle, the push is directly behind you. You don't get any swing on takeoff. They run on paraffin, which is less likely to blow up. You know, the jet engine has incredible advantages, although when they first came in, they all reckoned to be terribly difficult, and only special people were allowed to fly them. But it was absolutely nonsense. It was far easier to fly a jet aeroplane than anything else. Anyway, so you went up there, and you started on... it was the same old business, an RAF station. There were hunters there, and we were a little naval detachment, and there was a commander who was in charge of it. Again, had a very easy life. We only saw him once a week or once a fortnight, and the rest of it was done by the RAF. And we started off on the T-11, which was a two-seat, side-by-side training sort of Vampire. It was a twin boom aircraft, but it was really horrible to fly because you were very hunched up, and it had the stick was pivoted in front of you, so only the top half of the stick pivoted backwards and forwards, and you were sort of nudging the training chap who was with you in the right hand seat. It was terribly claustrophobic, and you had because when you ejected out of it, your legs might flail and hit the edge of the cockpit. You had sort of special string, well, they weren't string, they were nylon straps that you had to thread through your a thing round your trousers, and then it fixed onto the floor. So you felt you were trussed and tied into this horrid thing, and there was somebody else watching you, and it was just an awkward aeroplane, and it was used mainly for teaching instrument flying. And really what we wanted to do was just barrel up into the sky. We didn't want all this awful cold-blooded training. So anyway, the day came when they reckoned that you were safe to...
Well, hang on, Dick. If we go back to the cockpit, I mean the cockpit, this must have been a vastly more complicated cockpit, surely, than a piston engine plane.
No,
different temperature gauges, different...
Yes, it had a jet pipe temperature gauge, it had an RPM gauge, but then you had an RPM gauge on your others. You also had cylinder head temperature gauges for your piston engines. No, it's a myth that, it's a sort of popular myth that you only very special people can fly jet aeroplanes, and this carries on to today. I mean, if you've been flying piston engine airliners, and then you join an airline that has, you know, they want to know if you've had any jet experience. Well, as far as I'm concerned, jet engines are the easiest engines to manage. They're basically, it's a turbine. So you've got a single shaft going round with turbine blades on it. One end is the compressor. It compresses the air, blows it into some sort of chamber where the fuel's squirted, and that drives the power turbine and squirts out of the end and gives you thrust. Whereas, as you know, on a piston engine, the pistons are accelerating downwards. They stop. They don't have to be accelerated upwards, they stop. All these bits going up and down, valves going up and down, it's amazing they hold together. Whereas your jet engine just hums around like a vacuum cleaner. Much better.
Was there any trepidation when you went?
Oh, excitement. It was all excitement, because this was the first time you were going to fly a single-seat aeroplane on your own. Well, of course, on your own, because it was single-seat. So you were taken out to the aeroplane, and
you'd just done this stint in the T.
Yeah, you'd done the T11, this trainer thing.
You said a twin boom. I don't know what that means.
Well, it had like your Lightning,
mm-hmm.
you know, which is that same configuration. The cockpit was a sort of little bit in the front. Then you had the two booms that came back from the wings with the tailplane across it. And the FB5 was just the same. It had twin booms. And you got in, you'd read the pilot's notes.
This is the FB5 we're talking about now.
Yeah, excuse me. You'd read the pilot's notes, so you knew where everything was. You'd actually been allotted several hours to go into the hangar and sit in the airplane and find your way around. And you know, and if you were, your instructor would probably come out and say, where's the master switch? And there's the master switch. Where's the undercarriage lever? You know, you would do all that. So you were familiar with the cockpit. And then you were taken out to the airplane outside on the tarmac, and you got into it. This was your first flight. And once you were strapped in and happy, then an aircraftsman went round and got onto the tail. So the aircraft tipped up, and they said, that's the landing attitude. You know, because you sat right at the front of this aeroplane. You were right at the front, and the nose dropped straight away from you. Wonderful view. So you had no... It wasn't like a piston engine aircraft where you had the bonnet, if you like, in front of you, which gave you an indication of the angle. It was totally how you felt where the wingtips were and whether they were tilted up or down. And so, you know, it was quite a good idea having the aircraftsman on the back to give you an attitude.
Because there wasn't much clearance, I suppose, between the tail and the ground.
No, it had bumpers on it, so if you over-rotated the aircraft on landing, you know, the bumpers would tilt you forward and it wouldn't damage the aircraft unless you did it very heavily.
Was there a mnemonic for the vampire that you had to remember?
Oh, it would be Tafio again. Tafio works for all aeroplanes. Even big ones. So you did the same thing, and then it was time to take it off. And it was very quiet. Jet aeroplanes, you tend to leave the noise behind, whereas piston engine aeroplanes, you know, the engine in front of you and the exhaust in front of you, and so it's exhausting past your ears, in fact. So on takeoff, they're very noisy. Once they're in the air, the wind blast takes the sound away. But with the jet, there's virtually no sound right at the beginning. So you open the throttle, those shiny levers that they're always telling you about, push them forward, and the acceleration is quite fast. But then towards the end of the takeoff, when the speed's built up and the compressor's getting some effect from your forward travel, you then get a big acceleration in the final stages of takeoff. And then you just leap into the air, and you're on your own, and you've got this fantastic view out of the front of it. And of course, for the first flight, all you do is, as before, climb 500 feet, turn left, and land. And then once you can do that, well, once you've done it, then you just go off and do more and more landings, probably five or six in the one sortie, you know, then touch and go and roll off. And then you start your real training. And so you go, your instructor may be in another aeroplane, and you'll go up and follow him doing maneuvers, which is tremendous fun. It's called tail chasing. So, you know, he'll find a cloud and pull hard round it, and you pull hard round it, and imagine he's the enemy, and so on and so on. And so you get used to fighting the aircraft.
Straight, I mean, how many hours will you have flown by this stage? Not that many, surely.
No,
under 100.
Probably 100.
Yeah.
Yes, probably 100 at that stage. If I look in my logbook, wherever it is.
Okay. Do you want me to pause it?
Yeah, pause it.
Yeah. Hold on. Okay.
Yeah. By this stage, we'd done about 63 hours in the Provost on our own, and 62 duels, so that's 120 hours in the Provost, and the Vampire time, we did about 50 hours in the single seater and about 60 hours in the trainer. So altogether, we'd have, as you say, about 200 hours. Yeah.
So that's, well, I mean,
not many.
Yeah, it's not many. Pretty fast pretty fast training.
Yes, and over a short period of time as well. You know, it was concentrated. But, you know, those Battle of Britain guys probably had 50 hours.
What about your trainers on jets? Where were they from, your instructors?
Oh, they were the RAF men, again. They were, and they were older than the chaps we had on the Provost. But again, you see, they had it wasn't a very good job because they were always flying with us in the T-11, you know, which is a horrible aeroplane. I don't think anybody liked it. And it was all instrument flying, of course. You know, we were doing, you know, advanced navigation all over the place. And so there wasn't much fun involved in a T-11, whereas the FB-5, you know, we were always sent off to go and do, you know, high-level, high-speed runs, that sort of thing. It had a spinning limitation. This is what I think is crazy. We were sent off to do spins. And I think with the FB-5, after 5 turns, you had to bail out. In other words, if you hadn't recovered from the spin by 5, you had to bail out. But if
it would
never come out. It would just adopt a sort of falling leaf mode. It would just go round and round. I mean, there were probably some, you know, in desperation, maybe there was something you could do, but it had not been proven that, you know, stick fully forward, full opposite rudder would get you out, which is the way of getting out of an ordinary spin. So, and one of the guys on my course was killed. He went up to do the spinning practice, and obviously he didn't get it out, and then he tried to bail out and ended up with his parachute wrapped round the tail of the aircraft, and so, you know, that was him gone. But the other funny thing about the military is there was no funeral and we didn't go to it. I mean, there was a funeral, but I don't know where it was. It wasn't anything to do with the military. You know, as soon as somebody was killed, somebody else went into their cabin and parceled up their stuff and it was sent back to their parents. There was no formal recognition of it. In fact, 2 chaps on my course were killed, and there was a course of only about 10. The other one was a South African who, I think he was probably a bit slow on landing and went in. And unfortunately, the seat belt or the ejector mechanism fired and released his seat belt, and so he was rattling around in the cockpit as it was, you know, coming to a halt, and he was killed by the, you know, just being loose inside the cockpit, really. You know, like if you had a car crash without seatbelt on, it was just as silly as that. Yes, Chappy Varies, he was a nice man too. He used to carry this brown stuff in his pocket, and he'd say, "You want biltong, man?" And we didn't know what biltong was. And he said, "This is the very best buck biltong, man. You know, this is what, you know." He was a lovely man. And he'd shave you off with a very sharp knife. It was almost transparent, this meat, very dried. And it was like concentrated Marmite. It was incredible stuff. Yeah, so that was what happened to 2 of our guys. And then with that, when we'd finished that, we were then sent to the Navy fighter training school, which was at Lossiemouth in Scotland. So we went up to Lossiemouth for the next stage, which was then with the Navy.
And what planes were you flying on now?
Oh, now the really shiny levers came in. This was the Seahawk, which was relatively new airplane. It wasn't in service very long. It came in and then went out again. And these were virtually, you know, new airplanes. And this was sort of Navy training, so you had runways line made out to look like carriers, you know, with arrestor wires across and all the rest of it. And so you did some practice that way. But most of the time we spent fighting it, you know, so we did lots of dogfighting. There were target aeroplanes that towed a banner, which we fired at with live ammunition. Near Nairn, Lossiemouth was the Firth, Moray Firth, isn't it? There was a rocket firing range, which was a sort of a bay in the cliffs with a ring of buoys and a buoy in the middle. And so you rocketed at those buoys. And we got really good at this because we actually found out that the only, as they did in the Battle of Britain as well, all this fancy shooting and all the rest of it, that doesn't produce results. You just get so close you can see their white of their eyes and then fire. And that way you can't possibly miss. And with this rocketing, we just got lower and lower. And in the end, my group of chaps one day shot all these boys away. So there was nothing to shoot at anymore. We shot them all. That was a great day.
What about, again, the cockpits? This, now you've got, again, a different cockpit. I mean, you've got the standard gauges, but you've got weapons, you've got...
Yeah.
A much more complicated drill now to go through.
It's very complicated with weapons because, you know, you mustn't touch anything. You know, you don't touch it because, you know, it might fire something. And there have been many occasions on the ground where, you know, people have shot off, you know, 500 bullets in one go because, you know, they leant on it or they hadn't, you know. There are several switches you go through to arm something. And if they're not all set to off, of course, you know, one go on the trigger, or if there's a fault, could be a fault in it. You've then got a really lethal weapon. Yeah, so you've got to go when you're armed. You know, you get into the cockpit and you put your hands outside on either side while the armourers perhaps connect up the firing wires to the rockets. And things like that, you know, your hands are outside. You can't possibly touch anything while the poor guy's connected it all up. The ammunition for the guns is a bit different. That's all in there when you get in. But, I mean, you've still got to be very, very careful. And before you do anything, think, sort of thing. The cockpit's no more complicated other than the arm ring switches, the fact that the... control column has a firing trigger on the top of it, but then so did the FB5, but it of course wasn't armed when we flew them. You've got a gun sight in front of you which comes up and down and is worked by a twist grip like a motorbike on the throttle to alter the ranging knobs on the glass. Other than that, it's very similar to any other airplane. All the time you're trying to get, not be sort of too type specific, it's an aeroplane. I remember one of the instructors saying, if you ever get an emergency, if you're on fire, forget about it, fly the plane. Fly the plane, don't worry about anything, fly the plane. Because if you keep flying the plane, you can sort these other things out. But if you don't fly the plane, you're lost. You know, you've got to fly the plane. And it's the same later on when you fly different types. You know, you just, they're all the same. It's like cars, you know, they've all got steering wheel. They all think things are going to be familiar in minor details, but the major things are all the same.
What about the quality of the instruction? How was that? Was it top class? Did you have good instructors, bad instructors? Or were you buddied up with someone?
No, at Lossiemouth, I think the instructors with the RAF are very good because they get posted to that job as an instructor, and we were their third or fourth pupil, so they've learnt the job, and they're jolly good instructors. Once we went to the fighter training school, it wasn't quite the same because the chap that run that, he was, difficult to describe him. He always was sort of thinking we were too slow and we weren't catching on and we weren't aggressive enough. Because he was a sort of rugby person, and, you know, and we didn't play, well, my lot, we weren't interested in playing rugby. And so that, you know, that straight away we were non-people. I remember a couple of us joined the amateur theatrical group. That didn't endear him. So. And he was always being very disparaging to us, but that day when we shot out all the boys and nobody else had done that before, so he had to... he never climbed down, but he was... it wasn't a very happy place. It was very stressful, you know, they were always trying to push you on to do better. But
did you ever feel that you were being pushed too hard, that it was dangerous what you were being?
No, I don't think it was dangerous. It was just, it could have been much more pleasant, our time there. But it was winter time too, and there was a lot of ice, snow, frost. So you all had all these weather conditions to cope with, as well as the quite demanding training. And after all, we were being trained to be warriors. So, I mean, you know, it's bound to be hard, isn't it? You know, we were, that's what we were there for, to learn to fight the aeroplane rather than just fly it around, which we'd done before that.
And what was the strongest element then of that, fighting the aeroplane?
I think actually becoming unconscious of it. So you just willed it around. You know, I mean, you were obviously moving the controls, but, you know, you wanted to go that way, so your head went that way, and then the aeroplane followed. Well, you were obviously moving the controls to do that, but, you know, in the end, it became part of you. You were becoming instinctive. I think that's probably why they worked you so hard, because you hadn't got time to think. You just did it, or other way around. You didn't do it, you thought it. You know, you just thought the plane there. You thought it there, because we were still sort of doing World War II sort of combat things where you were fighting in dogfights, and we were armed that way, so we had machine guns and in the wings and that sort of thing. So the only thing we would be any good at, that aeroplane, was that sort of thing. It didn't have heat-seeking missiles or any of those sort of things that they use now. So actually dogfighting was important.
And the rocketing, I mean, that was for obviously ground attack.
Yes, it was, because the squadrons we were going to were called FGA, fighter ground attack, and the aeroplane was an FGA Seahawk. You know, that's what they were for, fighter ground attack. Yeah, the Hawker Seahawk. That was the aeroplane we were flying, and they were obviously worn out hacks, probably from squadrons on ships, which we had there. And then when we went to squadrons, you know, you got new aeroplanes or refurbished ones. There was several air bases which were maintenance units which took aeroplanes from carriers, took them completely apart, new engines, new wiring looms, new everything, put them all back together, repainted them. So we were like reconditioned aeroplanes. And That was going to be our ultimate job, you know, as maintenance test pilots. We would go to those bases, and as they came out of the factories, we would then test fly them and rectify the faults they had, or the, report the faults. Then they would be issued to the squadrons again. So that was going to be our job. But they wanted us to go through all the ordinary pilot training so that we had a view of that as well.
You could bring your engineers back.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
Trouble.
Yeah, that's right. Bring our engineering experience to it.
What about landing then? I mean, landing with Arrestorwise, you first did that up at Lossiemouth.
Yes, we went.
How was that taught?
They were marked out on the runway. First of all, and then you flew. An instructor would be in the position as if he was a batsman on a carrier, and you then flew in as if you were landing on the carrier, and then he would give you feedback on, you know, you were too high or you're too fast and all those sort of things. And then I think we went to Yeovilton. There was somewhere, there was a mirror landing aid, and there were Arrestorwise there, actually properly rigged.
For the first time you've landed?
Yes, but it was on a runway, so you had miles of head. But you flew, first of all, round and round, flying the mirror landing aid down to the deck.
Do you remember the name of this mirror landing aid, what this particular one that you trained on was called? Or?
No, it was just called the mirror. It was developed, we invented it, and then the Americans developed it. You know, it was a typical British system. And I'm not so sure that the system we had wasn't actually American-made. But it consisted of this parabolic mirror, which was gyro-controlled, so that it always pointed up to the horizon at 3 degrees, which is your landing slope. And then there were two, there was a light that shone into it, which then therefore would go up at 3 degrees. And there were a bar of lights on either side of the mirror, which was the centre line. So if you were flying around in the right place, that you'd see that ball of light in line with the other ones. If you were too high, that ball of light would be too high and or too low relative to the crossbar. So as the Americans, they called it the meat ball, because if you didn't fly the ball, you were just dead meat. So you flew the ball, which was very easy, far easier than, well, you know, it was just like flying an ILS, really, an instrument landing system. You just, you know, if you were low, you would tweak the airplane up a bit, put a little bit of power on, come back up to the line. Of course, the closer you got to the mirror, you had to be much quicker than that. You know, you were really working to keep it in the thing. But if you'd got yourself into the groove way out in the turn, and you had the aircraft nicely balanced and at the right speed, it would virtually fly itself down.
And what was the speed, the landing speed, can you remember, roughly?
Well, it was around about 100 knots.
So there'd be leeway between stalling and...
Oh, yes, quite a lot above stalling, yes, yeah.
Unlike the Seafire, where you had to fly it in 3 knots.
Yes. Yes,
that's another story.
Yes, that's right. When you actually went to the ship, though, you had to cut that speed down a lot. You were probably 10 knots above the stall.
So you did a series of these landings with the meatball and and the wire.
Yeah.
And
then...
How was that? I mean, was that sort of sweaty hands?
Yeah, it was sweaty, yeah, because you hadn't done it before and you knew now you were getting nearer to the deck. The deck was the big thing. You were going to go to the deck. You know, that's where it sorted the men from the boys. And we finished that training, and then we went. Then we got our, you know, we got our appointments to our various squadrons. And
Nick, how long was the advanced training? How long was that? Can you remember?
It looks like only 9 months. But you were flying every day.
How did you rate the Seahawk as a plane after? I mean, you'd been on the Provost,
yes,
a different ball game, and then the Vampire, and then the Seahawk, and with each time it was like a quantum leap forward, was it?
Yeah, it got easier. I mean, the Seahawk was far easier to fly than the Vampire. Well, the Vampire was made of wood for a start, wood and aluminium, and also it had this business that it had I didn't have an ejector seat, so at the last resort you had to climb out on the wing, and we knew what happened to our friend. The Seahawk had an ejector seat, and at that stage Martin Baker was developing these seats all the time, and the seat we had, you could fire it through the cockpit roof, so you didn't have that business, you know, you've seen the film, the pilot's trapped in the plane, he can't get the hood open, all that stuff. We could just, well, the story was, when in trouble, through the bubble. So you just shot out through the perspex. And it wasn't a ground level one, but it would work, I don't know, I can't remember, but it was, you know, quite low. It would work at, I think, 250 feet.
And how were you trained to use that?
Oh, they just showed you where the thing was. They didn't train. No, they've always been very cagey about letting you practice these things. Well, you do hurt your back, and you know, then they are dangerous things. You're attaching yourself to something that, like a bullet, you know, firing yourself, or like a rocket. Yeah, so they didn't. You never did practice parachute jumps or any of that. You did hanging in a parachute harness and dropping onto the floor and releasing it and all that sort of thing, you know, learning how to keep your feet together. Did those things, but they would never let you. Well, you might enjoy it too much and jump out too early. Yeah.
So you come to the end of your advanced training and you're proficient, you've hit all the targets.
Yes, we passed out, yeah.
And you could land.
Yeah, we could do that. We hadn't actually been to the deck, though.
So you pass the training, so the next major event is the deck.
Yes, well, it's first of all the posting to your squadron, because your squadron may not be on a ship. It might be at Broadie, you know, an air station somewhere. But I was posted to 804 Squadron, which was working up. you know, in other words, whole lot of new pilots and new commanding officer at Ford at Littlehampton. So we joined there, and they were mostly young guys. We were the most inexperienced, of course. We'd just come from the fighter school. The others had probably been on squadrons before, but there were about
Real six, Richard right. Songer.
Yeah, so there were quite a few of us new guys, and we were working up there.
I'm just going to stop.
Yeah.